So today we're facing several headwinds in this fast-paced tech economy. There's this global race to actually win in the advancement of artificial intelligence between the East and the West. However, what we're finding is that there are these clear impediments that persist to drive change in our current technologies that are hampering this speed to win. So there's this realization of how brittle our systems are because of the harms that we're seeing, whether or not it's bias, whether or not it's deep fakes, or the pervasive scraping of data. This has actually permeated a lot of our platforms and communication systems, and it's creating this increased risk that we're starting to see that's now resulting in a lot more regulatory attention, public awareness of the things that could potentially happen to ourselves individually. And this is in locked space with the pace at which technology is advancing. So welcome to Tech Uncensored, everyone. My name is Hesse Jones. Things like ethics, safety are now synonymous with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this has taken a step front and center when it comes to AI. Because the technology is so pervasive across sectors, across culture, across society, it's more important that we ensure that this technology works for everyone. And so this increasing awareness has bled into venture capital. And companies that continue to get funded are dominated by many of these large VC institutions that have historically not been diverse. So I'm just going to throw you a few stats on how DEI has evolved within venture capital. Female representation. Women represented 26% of the VC workforce in 2023. That's actually increased from 50% from 2016. The good news is that the percentage of firms that actually reported they do not have female investment partners has actually decreased to 57%. And that's down from 65% in 2018. We're also seeing an increase in Black employees within the VC space. But at the senior levels, Black professionals only totaled 4%, which is slightly up from 2018 at 3%. What we're also seeing is that nearly 50% of VC firms surveyed are actually incorporating DEI strategies in their organizations. And that is up significantly from 15% in 2016. So these statistics start to highlight the ongoing efforts and challenges on improving DEI within the VC sector. I am pleased to have with me today Gayatri Sarkar. And she is the owner of Advaita Capital. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. One of the only growth VC funds in the U.S. And Gayatri is one of the few women-led, POC-led venture capital companies in an already tight industry. So we're going to talk to Gayatri to talk about the state in the VC space, especially when it comes to disproportionate investment for underrepresented founders, and also the state of, representation of women and women of color within the VC space. We'll talk about DEI. Is it working? We'll talk about our views on AI, the AI industry, where it's headed, especially since her company is also investing in AI. We'll talk about her company, Advaita Capital, which is a Series B fund. She has so many things going on. She has SheVC, which is an organization that wants to level the playing field when it comes to curating women, diverse GPs and LPs to drive change within the DEI space. So, and we're also going to talk about her most recent appointment to the Princess Grace Foundation of Monaco. So that's going to be a lot. Welcome, Gayatri.
Thank you so much. I know you for such a long time, but I'm in awe of the amazing work that you're doing in AI and DEI space. And I'm so thankful that you have invited me to speak about it. And I have not spoken to a podcast for a long time. I think the last one I spoke into one of the AIM podcasts for the Asian American LPGP community. And I'm excited to be here speaking with a friend, and we have a lot to discuss.
We do. We have tons to discuss. And I'm in awe of any woman VC, especially a GP who has started a fund at a time when, you know, it seems like an uphill battle. So let's start with that. Let's start about your journey to venture capital. How did you get here? What was your interest early on to actually move towards where you are today?
Oh, wow. That's quite a story. So I never wanted to be a venture capitalist as such, or an entrepreneur, because I'm not only a VC, I'm also an entrepreneur. This is my fun. So I'm an immigrant. I was doing my PhD in physics and got a job and then moved here. Worked in Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Goldman Sachs, Federal Reserve Bank. I used to manage U.S. Treasuries assets for U.S. military and Navy. Also a couple of large banks there, JP Morgan, PNC, GND, Visa. After Federal Reserve Bank, I was requested by a couple of some of the largest hedge funds to join in U.S. or in London. And London was a separate, different conversation for my husband. And I decided at that point of time, and I think this was 2015, and I do believe there was some kind of a shift that happened, cosmic shift, because when you're an immigrant and you move to U.S., your number one focus is that you want to make sure you maintain your status. Your status quo is your steady check. And so for me, after Federal Reserve, I realized that, you know, I don't want to be in the hedge fund world. I wanted to be more focused towards technology. But if there's an interest that I can do in technology advancement or finance, and that's when, coming from the asset management background, it helped me a lot that I want to more focus towards venture capital. So I definitely think it's a cosmic shift that told me, like, maybe I should think about venture capital. And because, as I said, I was not growing up to say, oh, I want to be a VC, or even while working in asset management, I never had that interest. So I worked in a few VC funds, and then we had a small minority TMT fund, which we sold it. Then I was working with a $40 billion PE firm. We were looking at a $1 billion DEI fund. Unfortunately, that didn't go anywhere. And that's when I was thinking, you know, maybe I still have some mileage left, because I'm still pretty young for a GP to start their own firm. And one of the biggest catalysts of that decision maker was SheVC. So when I was running my other funds, I started a podcast. And in those days, the concept of video podcast was not there. So podcast means it is very high profile, like SiriusXM and all these things. People go to somebody's office to do a podcast, and the concept of Zoom video podcast did not exist. And this was before Black Lives Matter movement became such a big thing. My question was more like, you know, I come from a different background in tech, and I was a database architect. I was sometimes one of the few women in the room. And I was like, where are the women GPs and women LPs? That was my first question. And I was like, why? Obviously, there are many, but why don't we hear from them? And that's when I started the SheVC podcast, and I used to invite all the GPs, woman-owned funds that have closed their funds, and or woman LPs that are running pension funds. So we had OMERS, we had State Wisconsin Board, we had, you know, some of the largest pension funds. We also had some great representations from as small as fund like Glasswing, it's from Boston, to fund of funds like Crossweek from Utah. To we have representations from General Catalyst and others. So I was very much focused on understanding. It's like, okay, representation matters, and that's how you start the conversation of capital deployment, and capital equates to power, as we all know. And I wanted to hear from them their journey. And while going through that, I kind of realized that, oh, wow, there are not many women who are working in the growth phase, on the growth side of the venture. And that's when that stuck with me, that maybe I want to do something in that space. I come from a tech background, so we talk internally. And my husband was like, this is what I was afraid of. I was kind of mini retired, had a young child, and I was thinking of much more focusing on raising a baby. Because I, in my life at that time, I kind of has done whatever I wanted to do. And this is a something I should tell you. While growing up, I never had a role model. Because my mom is a housemaker and she's amazing. But when I see my mother-in-law, she's a Wall Street banker. She has worked in an area in a completely different time. But I wanted to grow up to be a receptionist or something like that, or an astronaut. Astronaut did not work. I'm obsessed with space. But I was like, okay, being a receptionist, because I always see this pretty woman sitting at a corporate job. And I was like, that's amazing. And this is where the problem in the society is, that we don't see much representations. So coming back, yeah, and that's how we started the Advaita Capital. The name Advaita means it's a, I come from an atheist family, but I found my own spirituality. It came from a philosophy, Hindu philosophy, which means non-duality. And if you think about quantum physics or Schrodinger's cat, the observer is deciding in which state we are. And that's where I was like, I cannot think about a better name that points towards the entire cosmic spirituality that exists and the quantum physics of it all, which is non-duality. So I do believe, you know, space, time, and other things work very differently sometimes. And whether we live in a simulation or where we are, we just don't know. But at the same time, I wanted to choose a name which was very unique. And also most of the Tiger Sequoia and other names are taken. So I named my firm Advaita Capital. So we invest from Series C onwards. Our thesis is deep tech. We invest in technology that is advancing human race and decarbonization focus and energy transition. So we invest in companies with 25 million ARR. We have invested in Canada also, in one of the top generative AI name. Our checks are 10 million onwards, but we can write 50 million plus checks as well. I'm based in Boston. We have some team members based in West Coast. We primarily invest in US, a little bit in Europe and Israel. We are hoping that down the road, we can do a little bit of early growth of Series A and B so that we can write further checks on the decarbonization focus that we have, because there are not many companies to write checks who has 25 million ARR in the decarbonization space.
So you had said something earlier about being one of the few funds that was actually in the growth stage of venture capital. What were you seeing with the other women GPs? Were they more early stage? And what was your foray into the venture capital space? How was your firm received by those who had been there for quite a long time? And you are now kind of stumbling into this community of this tightly knit group of, I would assume a lot of them are Silicon Valley led, VC institutions. Tell me what that was like.
Okay, so that's a lot of questions. So I think we are one of the few woman, person of color led venture capital firm in the industry, and in the growth side, not in the early stage side. There are some amazing women doing early stage venture capital. We decided, as I said, to focus on growth because of our background. The team is very private equity. And we have a lot of Harvard, MIT, PhDs, Yale under my CFO. She's Yale undergrad, Wharton MBA, 20 plus years of venture capital experience. So we come from a little bit of a large asset management background, and also the deep tech background. Having that experience, we felt we are much more suited to do what we can do. Plus, there's a black hole. And I think the main focus was like, can we invest in more women? And unfortunately, there are not many women. out there in the growth stage. And our main focus is investing in extreme outliers, the companies that are actually creating major growth, and it's going to be major outliers in the industry. So obviously, generative AI is one of the space. Ship designing, again, circular economy, but not in software SaaS space, but more in the hard deep tech space. And what was your other question? I forgot.
Fundraising.
Okay. So I want to be mindful because I know my compliance don't like us to talk about fundraising, but we are a growth fund. So obviously fundraising is all institutional LP. It was very tough. It was very difficult in order to have that conversation. But, you know, one thing I'll tell you, I'm a single child. I always say I have a single child syndrome. If you want it, you go for it. And someone who studied physics and math, physics, math and economics, it's like you need to understand the first principle thinking of how money moves. And one of the first decisions we made is like we cannot take money from ultra high net worth individuals or smaller family offices because it's a growth fund. We need larger sum of capital. We need larger sum of capital for separately managed accounts, for follow-ons, for co-investment. So thankfully, all our LPs are large institutions. It took a long time to convince, but one of the things I never compromised was our deals. We only invest in extreme outliers, the best of the best. And obviously, some of the people we are competing on the cap tables are Sequoia, Thrive, and others. They are big existing firms. But, you know, once upon a time, they also have started. So we think there is a new world order that is coming in venture capital space. And we are happy to be a part of this right now because we believe that, as you will see, more changes will be coming in venture capital space. Some of the older firms are winding out. We are seeing it. And newer firms are coming and they will establish themselves. And that's where we think we need to work really hard because the number one focus, you know, in any asset management firm, we are a venture capital firm, but we run like an asset management firm, is, you know, returning money for your limited partners. And we don't want to sway away from that because we are not doing any charity. When we are investing, we are very much focused on what can we give back on our limited partner side. And we want to keep that goal. But also at the same time, we want to invest in the areas that we understand. Taking the risk mitigated approach is very important for us. We are extremely thankful. Sometimes I cannot believe that we have support from so many institutional LPs from all around the world. But also the fact that they believed in us, that we said that we are going to do it and we did it and they believed in us. One of the thing about success I've seen is just showing up. If you show up and you continuously basically deliver what you said you will, I think sometimes the limited partners are like, okay, you know, she said she's going to deliver and she's delivering. It takes time. It takes a long effort because you're talking about institution. One of the things that helps us is that we all came from institutional backgrounds, but at the same time, you know, we said we are going to deliver and we will deliver. Sometimes it takes 2 to 3 years of conversion, limited partners, but again, these are institutions. Once that's yes, that's a long-term yes, and it's a lot of capital that we can manage, but our focus is that we continue to stay in the lane where we think we will do the best. Also, understanding the entire macro part, that what works, what doesn't work. Like we nowadays don't invest in software and SaaS because we know there's a big infrastructure shift is coming. And that's why we were at the right time and the right place to invest in infrastructure. And the team coming from the deep tech background also helped.
Okay. I want to touch on something about the fact that there are fewer women led startup companies in the growth space, in the growth side. I'm going to throw some stats that talks about this funding gap between males and females, white versus people of color. And I want you to respond to it. So a few of these female-founded companies represented 25% of the total VC deal count in the U.S. The proportion of the total deal, like year over year, remained flat at about 17%. These are women-led founders who are funded. In Europe, only 16% of general partners in the VC firms were women. So this is, and here's the other thing, women-led startups still receive less than 3% of all VC investments. How do you respond to this? Like, especially, I know DEI is very, I'd say still nascent in the full scheme of things, but do you think it's working even incrementally?
So I'll say the very first thing, that we are talking about it, it's working, that people see that there's a gap. But at the same time, there's a lot needs to be done. There's so many women who had to IPO their companies after Series A and B raising because they could not raise Series C, Series D because there's no woman writing larger checks for them. This is a major issue. You look at Stitch Fix, you look at others. Venture capital itself was a very nascent asset class. It was not even an asset class. And I feel like it was more like, you know, the Silicon Valley, some of the funds that were writing checks. And it was also very network-based. It still it is. It is very hard to get into cap tables of certain companies. Somebody is advocating for you. Somebody is saying that, no, this is a great company. Please take a check. And we are still like, we are a growth fund. So when we are writing a check, it needs a lot of board approvals, you know, founder approvals and all these things. But I feel like there are multiple issues associated with it. And it's a systemic problem. One of the issues is that I'll say is that there are not many women running growth fund is a big issue. When I started my firm, and I will not name the consulting firm, but we are on major consulting firms platform. And one of them said that, you know, why don't you go and raise an early stage fund? Like raise a $20 million fund or like raise a $50 million fund. And I was like, our focus is to do growth. Why should I raise a $50 million fund? And how many checks I can write? And those checks will not even make any sense. Similarly, a lot of people said, oh, why don't you raise a $10 million fund and then think about raising something bigger? But I was like, okay, we are talking about completely different set of investments. And one thing that you need to understand, and the reason I'm so glad we are having this conversation, growth investment is completely different than early stage investments. We don't as such invest in power, unless we have SoftBank kind of a money or Tiger kind of money. But then we're seeing now what is happening when you have too much of money and you have this deployment push that you have to deploy in a certain period of time. And you're like, you know, I don't care. I will build an index fund. That doesn't work. That's not how venture capital works. Venture capital is all about ingenuity of the people, the founder. You cannot invest in a B team and an A product. You have to invest in an A team. If the product is A, that's great. If the product is not A, it's a B product, they can still make it as an A product. So it's a continuous iterations. And we as an investor are big supporters of that iterations. That's all I can say. Now, so many women that are in the early stage, they're raising money. And I feel like there's a lot of support that is needed for these women to come in the growth stage. But we are, I think, seeing many women running early stage successful fund, it means that we are doing something good. And we will see a lot of these early stage funds, you know, down the road, we'll be raising Series A, B type funds as well. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, a lot of education that needs to be done. And also the idea is like, if you're a woman, that means you are only doing fashion or some kind of a woman-related stuff. I think that idea also needs to change, you know, whether it is our DNA sequence or various other things. Those are all done by women. My favorite model is Marie Curie, the only person who has won Nobel Prize in physics and chemistry. So I feel there's a lot of work that has happened in the past. We need to keep continuously push this to see more capital coming in the hands of women, and also the institutionals to open up. One thing I can say is that I received zero DEI funding, zero. And a lot of people expect, oh, I might be having a lot of DEI money because I'm a woman, person of color running a growth fund. No. Most of my LPs or all of my LPs, they don't have as such DEI agenda who invested in us. But did they back us because we're a woman-owned fund? No. They back us because we have the best of the deals. But the reason I'm coming to the point is that I feel like there's a lot of work that needs to be done at the systemic level to see we give women more support. A lot of women, when they start their company, like I had two startups of my own. I had a successful consulting startup. Then when I was studying at Harvard, I did a tech startup that did not work out. And those were very, very early days. We were at Harvard Innovation Lab, and some of the best VCs used to come and give us advice. We had some of those VCs who are now, you know, very well-known funds, and they were like building their fund at that time, who came and gave us some great advices. But it's a long, continuous journey. It's not a sprint. And that's why one of the thing, what I can say is that even to see more women coming in the growth stage, we need to support that. The reason venture capital is where it is today, especially the Silicon Valley culture, the culture is all about, even if you fail, it's okay. Because even if you fail, the idea is like you might be successful in your second startup, third startup, fifth startup, 10th startup. The penalty is very less unless you're doing some money laundering or other things. But this is where the importance lies, that the penalty of failure is less, but the reward for ingenuity is very, very high. And that's where I think our mindset needs to be. I think for women, they also come up with, like when an amazing, talented woman we see, we also like, oh, okay, if you're fundraising, so when are you planning to get married? Are you going to have your kids? Who's going to look after your kids? These are the questions we get. And if somebody asks you that question, remember, they're not going to give you any money. Not a single LP asked me, who takes care of my child? You know, what does my husband do? If I am out there busy, who is managing my kid, who is managing my household? Those LPs are not giving you a check because nobody's asking that question to a man. I think that there's a lot needs to be done, but there's a lot happening. There's Check, Warner, Her Fund, and there's Carly, Her Fund. I think a lot of them, GPs that I'm naming, their funds are nowadays supporting daycare system to their founders. You know, I have a small child. My CFO, she has a 9-month-old and a 2-year-old. A lot of women nowadays, they have late children at late stage. Because we were so busy with our career. And I think making that career changes or career flow to be sustainable, making sure that they have that support. We live in a very ludicrous time where I live in Massachusetts. Massachusetts have unpaid leave, a maternity leave for unpaid for a month. I'm so glad I'm not poor and living in Massachusetts. I don't know what I'll do with a 1-month unpaid leave. So I think a woman body needs at least 6 months, you know, to get back to normal, giving birth to a child. And I think that's what needs to be ingrained in a lot of venture capital funds or corporates, like how to support this talented, amazing woman who are coming back into the field. I can go on and on so much about that. Yeah. But I need that support. Yeah.
I think so. And this is me talking as a Canadian. And we've evolved to the point where women now have 1 year of maternity leave. And
amazing. That's a huge success than we Americans have.
Yeah, but there's a different mindset. And Europe is even much more progressive than everyone else is. When I was growing up, my mom had 6 weeks. That's almost equivalent to what the U.S. has today, is it not? Or have you got, you've gotten further than 6 weeks maternity leave?
So Massachusetts has 1 month unpaid maternity leave.
Wow.
So in my firm, if somebody's working in my firm, we have unlimited sick leave and unlimited vacation. But again, venture capital is not work. It's a lifestyle. So people are always working. But at the same time, we have given that unlimited option for somebody to take a break. I have such horror stories from Wall Street days. I was working with a limited partner, and there's a woman with whom I'm working, and she was, she's like, Gayatri, I need to tell you I'm pregnant, so I'm leaving the company. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, yeah, I'm leaving the company. She's one of the most talented women I've seen. And she said, because it is, I spoke with my boss and he thought that this is much, this is obviously the firm has a very hedge fund style background. And there's like, my boss said, this is much beneficial for me and for my career if I leave the fund instead of taking a long maternity leave. And I was like, that is the most regressive, you know, outlook I have heard. And that's where the things needs to change, you know. And I actually did not take money from that limited partner. I said, I'm not your money because this is the kind of attitude you have. And she was the only woman in their work field. And she's amazing. She was literally working, traveling San Francisco to New York, being 6 months pregnant. She was ready to do everything, but her firm was not. So, you know, and so.
That really sad.
Harvard, MIT educated bosses, you know?
Right. But I mean, that to me is, it's almost emblematic of like what women go through today. And I think that the mindset of a woman is always do things to in the utmost perfection. And with men, and I think from that perspective, there's a bit of, I'd say, confidence level that's diminished compared to men, because women have to always step up and be a certain level of perfection beyond what a man is perceived to be. Like the one thing, and I just went and came off a meeting, and we have a lot of founders that come to our accelerator, but for the most part, we're still heavily weighted male. And like, it's very difficult to get women to say, hey, I need some help. Can I come? And they are just as qualified, but they will wait until a certain point where they say, I need help. But by that point, they're so far along, far beyond what some of these founders are at, that they may not necessarily need as much help as everyone else. But I think that's what I find with women in general, is that they have a higher threshold of pain and a lower confidence level to be able to even ask for funding. What's been your experience with that?
I think, first of all, one thing I'll say is that I think women has imposter syndromes. That's for sure. But there's another thing I'll say. I think this is an example given to me by a friend, that a tree that bears most fruit is also bending a lot than a tree that has less fruit. So women who are talented, and I've seen men who are also talented, they suffer from this, whether we are doing it right. I have a team of PhDs from Harvard, MIT. They ask the maximum amount of questions. They're like, am I doing right? Is this wrong? Is this right? And I think when you see talented women at workspace asking those questions or having self-doubts, because they have, you know, more information, data among themselves, and making sure that they are at their best. But I feel there's a obviously different way the society is judging us. And many of us, including me, are standing over the amazing work that is done by women. I mean, I was telling you, like, my mother-in-law, she's a Wall Street banker. She is one of the few person of color. She does not look much Indian, but she's one of the few person of color in the 70s and 80s working in the bank. And and she has a very normal name. Her name is Maya, and nobody used to even take her name properly. It was the easiest name. And people used to confuse her whether she's Mexican or, you know, or Middle Eastern. And then the biggest issue with her is that she was told multiple times, bring a male coworker so that we can have a conversation with you, whether it's a closing of a deal or other. So, or people will use profanity in front of her face. That was Wall Street, you know, and we have come a long way. She was also put into accent training. And this is the funniest thing I want to say is that my mother-in-law, even if I say that, and she's like, but you know, they paid for it.
Oh my goodness.
I think it's a different world, you know, and think about people like us nowadays. I don't have to worry about, hey, where is your male coworker? And then I'm going to invest in your fund. So that's why I said, like, there are progress that is happening, but it is going to take some time. And I feel, and I'm very optimistic about it. It is not going to happen at a super fast pace, because at the end of the day, we are dealing with not AI, but human beings. And I think there are more mind shift that needs to be changed. And this change needs to come organically. I think the biggest change that we see, and we were discussing, like, as a millennial parent, as I was saying, my husband is more involved in raising my child. He has done more diaper changes than me, where our parents, my dad was never involved. His father was never involved. And my mother-in-law managing Wall Street and raising a kid. So it's a different time that we are living right now. There are changes happening. And I'm very optimistic about it. That's all I can say.
Okay. No, that's good. I don't want to beat that to death, because I know, I understand, like, even in today's stats, it's very, very difficult for a woman to raise money, especially if they only had, let's say, a female investor that invested with them in the first round. To get to a second round is almost less likely, unless there's a man, a male involved in the first investment round. That's a stat that I'll put out there, and I know things will get better. But I want to shift a little bit and talk about technology, because you have this passion for these types of technologies that we're investing in the future. And I want you to talk about it. Generative AI, there's been the launch of Sora most recently with OpenAI, and now the ability to develop video from text. And, you know, you've seen the growth of Gemini. You've seen a lot of some of the innovations that are taking place like crazy when it comes to natural language processing within generative AI. Where do you think it's all going? And what are you excited about?
So I'll come back to our thesis, which is our infrastructure thesis, that we believe that we are living in the time of 60s and 70s. The changes that happened and led to the huge growth of internet, we're living right now. So this is the next 25, 30 years. We are going to see the growth of not only just computing powered through generative AI, but also this will lead to changes in, opportunistic growth in quantum computing, because we know the laws of physics is kind of a hindrance when it comes to quantum computing. A lot of growth in chip designing. We might see finally, you know, interplanetary travel or something like that, or flying cars. And I hope that happens, because I feel we are living in a time of a huge infrastructure growth, and a lot of infrastructure tech investment is going to happen. The real Silicon Valley, that you're like, okay, where is the Silicon Valley? Because everybody's investing in app. And I think that change is coming right now. We will see, you know, the rise of Silicon Valleys again. That is right now with OpenAI, XAI, or other companies that we are seeing. So I am definitely positive and that we are living in a time, and I'm so glad I'm living in a time where I'm an investor in this space, that we get to see so many things. Somebody who studied physics, and we have a team of engineers, for us, this is like a huge playground to learn, go through things. Like yesterday, I had more than an hour long session with my team. And, you know, these are the people we have also former Google DeepBrain scientists in our team. And we were all brainstorming on certain ideas like, okay, for our next investments, where do you see the movements coming? Because for us, it's like when we look at an investment, we just don't look at a product. Oh, this is a great product. Let's invest. We want to understand from the macro scale how the changes are happening in the infrastructure AI space. And we want to understand where this fits. There are different theses. There are different analogies. So I think generative AI is at a very, very early phase. We are at a phase where it is more crawling. And that's why we are like, just like kids, we are like, oh, wow, we can literally translate text into video, text into picture. So definitely at a very early phase. And then as when I wear an investor hat, I want to understand where we can actually make money and how, which are the companies that are sustainable and which are the companies that have some kind of corporate governance to make things sustainable. And obviously there is this big focus towards open source, closed source. And we want to make sure as an investor where we can make sure have the good return.
So how much of your LPs, by the way, how much of them care about a portfolio that has some kind of, let's say, DEI measurement around it? Like, is that going to be injected as one of the things that your LPs will be looking for in terms of how you invest your money?
Great question. So one of the things I want to say is that you don't want to be the GP where your mission, your ethos, and your thesis is driven by LPs. My LPs don't care, but one of the reasons they chose us also, they know that we care. I'm not going to invest in a company where they could not find a single woman in their team. One of the biggest examples is that we were looking at a company and they were serial entrepreneurs. They were kind of billionaires. They had a huge successful and not named the company. They came out of that company and started not a generative AI company, but an AI company that has some defense tech alongside it. And I asked them, I said, like, I love your team, you could not find a single talented woman in your team. And he said that, actually, we are in part of a country which happens to be Connecticut, not very far from where I'm living right now. There are not many talented women, we couldn't find. And that's why we couldn't hire. But we do have a receptionist or I think executive assistant. Mm. And I feel like that was not the right answer. It's okay that you can say that, you know, we did not do a good job in searching for great talent who also happens to be a woman. I run a farm where my entire team is diverse, and we all come from great schools and great experiences. And you don't have to go and say, oh, it's time to go and look out for a woman or a person of color. And this is where I think the diversity is failing. You know, it's like, okay, let me have talented people in my team, but they also happen to be a woman. So, and I feel like his answer should have been like, you know, we didn't do a good job, but I think we will try to find more great talents, but the answer is like, oh, no, there is no talent, when we are living and where we're finding. That's not the right answer. Decided not to invest in that company. Also, that company was also because it was not an extreme outlier. We don't invest in a company because the company needs to have a diversity mandate. But when we talk to the founders, we try to understand how they look at the world. because 50% of the population is female. So how you're looking at your consumers, and we are enterprise-focused venture capital firm. So we try to understand if you have the similar ethos, the mentality. I know nowadays DEI gets a lot of bashing, but I think there should not be dearth of meritocracy. And there are some amazing women that are coming out of every field. It should not be like you remove two women from your board and the company is working perfect. So we are seeing a lot of such examples. But I hope that there are changes coming and there will be further changes. But yet, the mandate is not coming from our LP. This is our own personal ethos when we ask questions. We also ask questions like, what's your data privacy? You know, we have invested in one of the top generative AI company because they have a strong focus towards data privacy. We also ask questions like, what's your carbon footprint? You know, what are you doing in terms of carbon footprint tracking? And these are the questions that I think every VC should ask, but this is part of our ethos, our operational excellence. And I think we cannot keep injecting money in companies who will keep on training models, God knows how long. So we are trying to understand the space from a scientist standpoint of view, and also from an investor standpoint of view, and also from macro analysis, how the market is going to evolve. Right. So we are at a disruption phase. So anything can happen. There might be a lot of changes. But I just don't want the law of large numbers to prevail, so that money is only accumulated to Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. And then there's a trouble. Because they have, you know, not only a lot of capital, they also have the consumer base, a client's customer base to gather so much of data. So it will be interesting to see how the generative AI prevails, because it's also training data. Having access to this raw data is very important. And right. I think which founder has access to this raw data. So it will be interesting to see. And one thing that I want to highlight is that this is we were discussing last year. Last night is that the disruption that's going to happen, we don't know whether it's an AGI or some other way, but whatever it is, and I can go extremely technical about it, but we need to give time to this space. I know there's a too much focus, hey, let's go to the market. And also there's this focus on let's inflate our valuation because we also need to keep on raising money to train our LLMs. So we will see like who has the first mover advantage, who is making the smart move. Because if you're not the best, then you cannot play in this space. And also as an investor, you need a lot of capital in order to invest in this space as well. So we are trying to take various game theory approach and various standpoint view to understand that who will be the winners. I'm glad I'm in this space as an investor, as an audience, just trying to make sure we take very risk mitigated approach so that, there's not much of a loss for us and there's more betting on good founders and we can be a good supporter to those founders and be rightly their, partners in making sure that when it comes to building great products, right mindset is set, not what we are seeing with few other things that we were discussing before.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm glad that you're actually kind of stepping out of the common fold and asking questions that maybe some VCs may not be asking, right? Because it is a balance between, oh, how fast can you grow? How fast can you actually deliver this? What is your revenue stream? But now, can we do this in a way that's not going to harm this type of population or et cetera, right? There is a responsibility from that perspective. Okay, so I know we're kind of running out of time. I do want to get to one question about your most recent appointment as a crown patron for the Princess Grace Foundation of Monaco. So can you tell me about that? That sounds so fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. We have been working with Prince William's Foundation because we're an official nominator of Earthshot Prize. And then Prince Albert of Monaco has a similar ethos when it comes to climate change. He has a big focus towards ocean tech. And we as a growth investor we are keenly looking at the blue tech space to understand. There's a lot of R&D that goes into it. And as we understand the space, it was a great opportunity for us, for me to be a crown patron of Princess Grace Foundation, which is Prince Albert's mother. But the main focus of the foundation is that how can we enable, underserved communities in the artist space, who can be the next Oscar winners, Grammy winners. And some of the other crown patrons are John Paulson, Leslie Odom Jr., Chuck Royce, Lady Tina Green, John Chu, who is the director of Crazy Rich Asians. He's also one of the actually previous winners of the scholarship from the foundation. So one of the thing that interested me into this, as you know, generative AI is going to disrupt many spaces, but the very first space is the Hollywood industry, the films and others. So we want to see that what we can do to make sure we can be much more, mindful of the disruption that is happening in the world, but also at the same time, understand how the AI space is moving me as an investor, looking at this opportunistic world. But, we are looking at this more of a philanthropic approach for us, and also working with Prince Albert's Foundation on many of his climate change space. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing like how that's going to be deployed and the types of, I guess, artists and projects that are going to come out of it and how they're going to thrive in the coming years.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Can I just add one more thing that the few things that I want to touch base on that when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and that has been the theme of our discussion, I want to say is that it's going to take a long time and a long process, but we also need to be making sure when we are deploying capital in the diversity, equity, inclusion space, where is the accountability? If somebody is giving you the DEI money, is there an accountability towards it? The reason I'm talking this about, because we just saw Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan coming out away from the climate action 100. And again, they raised a lot of climate fund, and currently them coming out of it, there's no accountability. Similarly, Goldman Sachs also had a launch platform, which was also a DEI focus. So one of the things I want to highlight is that to a lot of institutions, whether pensions and others, if you are focusing on investing money in a diverse GP, go and do that. Invest in a fund that is owned by a diverse GP, rather than allocating the capital to 1,000 other middle layers, then that gets dedicated to you have no accountability for, and then the output looks bad. It's the same situation where BlackRock and others said that, I'm going to invest in ESG, but actually it ended up investing in oil and gas, but in a better scenario. Mm-hmm. So what I want to highlight most in this today's world, it's like we need to be mindful. Everything starts with good intention, investing in climate, investing in diverse founders, investing in diverse funds. But in the process, we get lost. Like we have seen, there's so much of backlash coming out of, whether it's ChatGPT or Gemini. I'm sure they started with a good intention that I want to have a very diverse, inclusive thing. But diversity also means that you are including everybody, so you are not also giving non-accurate pictures of historical representations, because I think that is where I feel like we need a lot of work. And that's why there's so much of backlash. It's not a binary state. This is what I want to highlight is that, I know the government is suing SpaceX and others for them not having, immigrant workers. But again, that's a very high-end space where everything needs to be tight-lipped. So somebody who has worked at Federal Reserve Bank, I can totally understand that. So that's what I want to highlight is that we live in a space where it is a continuous journey. So mm-hmm. We should feel like we have reached that journey. Oh, we have deployed the capital. I am going to deploy 1 billion capital to DEI space, 1 billion capital to climate tech. That's where my accountability stops. No, you should go and check it out. What is the output? The output should not be what is happening with Gemini 1.5, where there's a complete misrepresentation of history. So I think we need to make sure there's a proper accountability of what you are doing. There's a meritocracy attached to it. And it's a long process. It's a long journey. And it will take us a long time to reach there.
It will. It will. I mean, let's just say that you live in the United States of America, which is a capitalistic country. And there is still very much the value to appeal to the shareholders, right? And shareholders, we know what they care about. So it's that balance that you talked about. And so for me, as someone who also invests in company, but also in companies, but early stage startups, it's about the value that you bring. And when people say, but whose values are attached to that output, there needs to be one that actually represents humanity. They need to have a vote. And then whether or not that's part of that vote is with the VC company or with the technology or the company who's actually building the technology, it has to be there. So thank you so much for providing your insights, because I think what you've said today shows that there's at least one company that's thinking about all of this from a collective perspective. And there needs to be, I think you need to influence a lot more of the VC community to think this way. Because yes, there is the ROI behind it, but there is definitely a human aspect that is going to impact all of us. So thank you. Thank you.
So say before I go is that don't take a binary approach to this. It's not, this is what I hear from this, the polarized binary approach. It will take a long time and it will take a lot of learning and feedback.
Absolutely. On that note, thank you, Gayatri, for your time. I think there is going to be a lot of hope. I have a lot of hope in the technology that is advancing today. But it's going to be in lockstep with the critical oversight, with the responsibility that comes with investment. And so that means this sector actually has to evolve with the times. And I know that will happen. So thank you. So for our audience, if you have any topics that you want us to cover in the future, like this one, please email us at communications@altitudeaccelerator.ca. That's all we have time for today. And I thank again my guest, Gayatri Sarkar. In the meantime, everyone, have fun and stay safe.
Tech Uncensored, an Altitude Accelerator podcast, does not constitute a recommendation for any organization, product, or service. It's produced and distributed by BlueMex. For more Tech Uncensored content, subscribe where you get your podcasts and visit BlueMex.io to join us on Discord.